This episode of Word for Word may contain language or themes that are not suitable for all listeners. If you're experiencing difficulty, please reach out for support. You can reach QLife, an anonymous and free LGBTI support service, by calling 1-800-184-527 or call Lifeline 24 hours a day on 131114 for crisis support and suicide prevention. In an emergency, please call 000.
Australia on the Community Radio Network to over 70 community stations around the nation. This is Word for Word, hosted by Lisa Dano Daniel, coming to you from Australia's LGBTI radio station, Joy.
Welcome to Word for Word. Today's guest has an incredible history of social justice, both career-wise and personally. She's a facilitator, capacity builder, researcher, and a closet artist. She's got over 30 years' experience working with older people and in 2018 was a Human Rights Medal finalist. Welcome to Word for Word, Catherine Barrett.
Thanks, Lisa. I'm delighted to be here and you've done your homework.
I have. I've just trawled the internet. It's amazing what you can find out about people just from their own Facebook page, and you've appeared on a few things. You've done a lot of work. I wanted to start off by asking where your sense of social justice comes from, given most of your career has been working in the social justice area. You don't seem to have a corporate background of any note. You're smiling now. I like that. Where does that sense come from?
I think it comes from my family, actually. So my parents had 14 children in 16 years. So that was a lot of people. Somebody asked me about that recently and I thought I must ask my mother. My mother has a really strong sense of social justice. Catholic family, country, proudly rural folk. And, you know, my family experienced a number of injustices. One of them has been, that we now know is part of growing up Catholic in Ballarat. And so they were very shaping experiences. You know, I had a very loving childhood and I thought that, if you did the right thing, everybody else did too. And that was kind of how the world works. But it wasn't how the world worked.
When do you think that got knocked out of you?
When I was 17, my sister was killed in a car accident and my brother was driving. And that was devastating. That literally broke my heart. I had so much pain in my heart that, I really had trouble breathing. For my brother was driving the car. He blamed himself. He became an alcoholic and he drank until he died. And then we had some other experiences. I won't go into too much, but, we had somebody who was assigned to pastoral care for our family because we were a good Catholic family in Ballarat, and that person crossed a line, and as we know, that was quite common in Ballarat, and that was the first injustice, and then the injustices after that were around my family members being silenced, and so we were silenced by the police, and we were silenced by lawyers, and we know that's the case. We know that from the Royal Commission into Institutional Responses to Child Sexual Abuse. We know that that there were whole systems and institutions that worked to protect the church. And, that's a real loss of innocence for me to believe that, to realise that is the way some people behave. I still find that incredulous.
So it was a double blow in terms of the death of your sister and the horrific involvement of your brother. It's a terrible tragedy for him and, as you say, pretty much cost him his life as well. So you've lost two siblings. And the pastoral, the involvement of the pastoral carer, that was around that time.
A priest, yeah. So pastoral care around my sister's death.
How many of you were involved in what happened with him?
So there were two brothers.
Younger.
Yes, yeah.
I know this is their story, so I won't ask you too much about it, but was it something that was revealed at the time or has that come to light?
No, it's come to light since, yeah. But, so, when you ask me about a sense of social justice, I think I got that from growing up in a big family. I got that from those later experiences, but also I was a bit of a different kid as well too. Don't you hear that so often? You hear so many people say they're a different kid. I was such a super nerdy kid and I always felt different. I always felt like an outsider.
In what way do you think?
I look at pictures of myself and I was a pretty nerdy kid actually. Yeah, I think from an early age I had a sense of what it felt like to be an outsider.
Where did you sit in the 14 siblings?
I was number five.
Five, so not kind of the middle, I guess.
Well, it felt very top. So,
it did.
So, you know, some people ask me why I didn't have children, and that was one of the reasons, because I felt that I'd done it. You know, I had nine younger brothers and sisters, and so that was a lot of babies' bottles and nappy changes. And, yeah, so I had a, you know, I felt like there were there was a lot of maternal roles in my upbringing, and so there's a sense of real closeness.
How does one live in a family where there's 16 people? Did you all live together at once, or was the older ones kind of moved off as the younger ones, you know, moved out of home?
Because it was in 16 years. I mean, you often hear of families of 10 or more, but often it'll be 20 plus years. I had two brothers that went to boarding school, but the rest of us were all at home. So it was like, you know, 10 or 11 of us going off to school together, catching the school bus together. And, you know, that's 2.5 loaves of bread. And I said the other day, you know, it's like 5,000 lunches a year and 20,000 toenails and fingernails. And, you know, it's a lot. But I think what I got from that was I got a real sense of community. And part of that was growing up in Ballarat. It was a community. Like, my family was a community, and I loved them all, and I still love them all, and in different ways and in different degrees. But still, that sense, I remember as clear as anything, that if one family member went off on school camp or something, I missed them terribly. Like, it felt quiet. But now it feels so busy. If I go home now and it's a family function, so you walk into the house and it can literally take you half an hour to get through the house because, you know, there's your two brother-in-laws and your nieces and nephews in the lounge and, hello, how are you? And so by the time you do that and you work your way around the room, they actually literally take half an hour. So it's not uncommon in my family for people to go, right, I'm going, and they're gone, because it takes a long time.
I'm interested in the fact that you have said that you feel like you didn't have kids because you felt like you'd already done that. It's interesting that you grew up in a house where there was, you know, say 14 to 16 people at any one time. So that's a crowded house. I'm assuming nobody had their own bedroom and that sort of thing. And now you've sort of gone the opposite way. You live by yourself now?
I do. Well, Agnes, the unmini schnauzer, I live with Aggie Pants. So, yeah, I do live on my own. I prefer the company of people, but I'm also a little bit of an introvert too, so I really cherish having downtime and quiet space.
Was that part of your childhood? Was that ever possible to have?
No, it never was. Downtime. It never was. There were no quiet times. But I see in the work that I do now that in a way it has been creating other families for me. So there's, you know, there's lots and lots of people, and it feels crowded and noisy, like my family, and that's something that's very familiar and comfortable.
How does your family come to terms with the death of your sister? I imagine, you know, such a sudden loss at such a tender age, just about to start her adult life, really. How does that affect a family?
Well, I think there was a lot of heartache and heartbreak, and I think particularly for my parents. Yeah, and we're all such incredibly different people. It's affected us in different ways, and there are still, you know, we still talk about Claire, and we all, you know, a number of us look alike. So sometimes, you know, I'll go somewhere and people will call me Claire instead of Catherine, and they go, oh, I'm so sorry, and they're worried that they've triggered something negative. But actually, I really quite love to be reminded of her, because she was a really very precious person.
So. I feel like we don't do grief very well in Australia. I feel like we go through a death, you know, a sudden death like your sister, like Claire, and people are great in the interim and, you know, between the death and the funeral and then for a few weeks after. And then we just sort of, it's like we're not allowed to talk about the person who's passed away. And I find that very curious, and especially hearing you say that you would prefer to talk about Claire and remember her rather than just pretend like she didn't exist.
Grief has a limited time span that people will accommodate your grief, but then there's a certain point at which I have a really strong sense that you're expected to kind of get over it. You know, I think particularly last year for me, I lost my very beautiful friend Kay. And, you know, Kay was the first proper lesbian that I met after I came out, and she was just the best role model, because she was so very ordinary. that was what was really fabulous about her. She and I were exercise buddies, so that was our way of catching up with each other. So three or four times a week we go off and do some exercise together. She went to the Out Games in August last year and she won 7 gold medals and 1 gold, 1 world record.
What was her sport?
She was a swimmer, so yeah. She swam with the Glamourhead Sharks. And, you know, one of them she did, it was a medley, so it's, you know, backstroke, freestyle, breaststroke and butterfly. Now, I think everybody knows what butterfly looks like. Well, Kay was doing butterfly and got a gold medal. And she had a lot of back pain and she had some nausea too. So we actually, so that was in August. And then in October she was diagnosed with, you know, she had cancer of the everything. And she had a month to live. You know, we thought she would have had longer, but she lived for a month. But one of the most beautiful things was watching the way LGBTI communities rallied. So there were a large number of people who would have done anything to have made Kay's life okay. And one of the beautiful things that I got to do was Kay and I used to talk about meditation a lot. So and she was getting a little bit restless. So one of the jobs that I was allocated was to lie on the bed with her and hold her hand and meditate. So we did guided meditation together. It was the most beautiful thing because I felt like I was bringing her peace. One of the most precious memories that I was inviting her to breathe in healing golden light from the sun into her heart and imagine that it was coming, you know, one by one from people that she loves. So, you know, from your beautiful partner, Claire, breathing healing golden light into your heart, breathing out, spreading it through your body, bringing you peace and bringing you love. And so that was for everybody she knew. And then I realised at the finish that I hadn't told her that I loved her. And I said, "You do know that I love you, don't you, Kay?" And she was holding my hand and she was really struggling by then. So she actually brought both of her hands up to the side of her face and just held my hand against her cheek and gave me the most beautiful smile. And she said, "Yes." And that's like, her partner came in and took a photo right then and there. And so I have that now forever in my heart. The way people rallied when Kay was dying, you know, it really buoyed me. I felt like I was in a world that was the right way up. But then what happened after her death is, you know, everybody, you know, we kind of all get on with our lives. And that was when the grieving really hit me. You know, and I felt like I wanted to stop the world and say, you know, can you just wait a little bit longer to respect this person because I'm not done yet.
Did it feel familiar to you in terms of having lost your sister and your brother before that?
I feel like all those experiences of grief were so completely different. So Claire's, you know, Claire had gone out for the day and then we got a phone call to say that she'd died and there was this absolute acute pain that then tapered off over years and decades actually. But then with Peter, my brother, alcoholism, so anyone who lives with someone who has alcoholism, it's such a roller coaster disease. So part of my grief was empathy and sympathy and hurt and then another part of it was anger. And so that had a very different shape to it, a very different shape and form. Kate felt completely different because there was a kind of knowing that she wasn't well. She'd had cancer so many times before and she'd always come through. And so it wasn't a surprise. And then there was this beautiful thing that happened that just felt, it felt like we all had our priorities right and everybody was loving. And then after that, it felt like an emptiness, actually. So that they, you know, if you were to map those out and draw them, they'd have very different colours and shapes and sizes. And
it's a great way to put it, actually, that if you mapped it out and drew it, that that would look very different. I've had a few people in here who have lost people and have either been there right near the end or at the end, and some will say that the dying person fought and that it was traumatic for everybody. It sounds like Kay had something about her as a person who was okay with her journey and the journey coming to an end. Would that be true?
Yeah, she was. She was. I mean, she was always a wise soul. She was very sort of philosophical and very wise and she knew herself very well. And when she was diagnosed, she said, "I've lived my life. I have no regrets. I'm not afraid to die." And there are a lot of us now that think about that and think, because she said it to many people, and that we think about that and we think that's a gift. That was a gift to watch her, you know, embrace her dying. But then to think, like for me, thinking about my own life, you know, I just thought, oh my goodness, could I say that? And so there was this real life reflection, and I realised that I had one or two regrets that I did want to address. So that's part of what I've been doing. But, you know, in every way, Kay was a gift. And I think one of the things that we do in life is we expect that we're here forever and we don't appreciate the people around us. And so that's one of the things that I think one of the lasting legacies from my sister Claire as well too. You know, she was we were at a very cranky stage, you know, 17 and 18, you know, sort of bickering like sisters. And then she left and she never came back. And I always regretted that I didn't tell her that I loved her more often. So it's one of the things that I do with my friends and family is tell them that I love them and thank them and practice gratitude.
How do you feel about death for yourself, having experienced the death of others very close to you?
Kay's legacy was an absolute gift in terms of that. I'm not as frightened as I was. I was frightened. I think most people don't think about death. But the work I do is around challenging ageism and respect for older people. And I've done some writing recently around terror management theory, and it so resonates. You know, this idea that we're so frightened of our own death that we spend our lives fighting or denying it, and that's underpins our disrespectful and disgraceful attitude towards older people. And one of the joys for me about working with older people is that I see this all the time. I see older people, I see morbidity and mortality, and I've had to, because of that, I've had to come to terms with my own old age and my own death in a way that it has become less frightening, and in a way that I feel like I'm now living my life in more authentic ways. And, you know, I say stuff and I do stuff that I would never have done before because I know that I'm not here forever.
Do you have a formal religion or a spirituality that you want to talk about?
I grew up Catholic and I now call myself a burnt Catholic.
What does that mean?
That means that I had experiences that I can't sit with the difference between espoused and actual. So a church or member or, you know, priests who espouse, you know, a kind of Christianity or a godliness, but then are not enacting that in actual life. And that might be in relation to sexual abuse, of particularly of children, but also to in their responses to LGBTI people. Like, that does not sit well with me.
How did you feel about the George Pell trial and the outcome?
I was fairly devastated, actually. He was a family friend of ours. And when I moved out of home and went and did my nursing training and got my own house, he was the first person I had around for dinner. So I always admired and respected him. And then to hear about what he has done, that is one of the reasons why I call myself a burnt Catholic, because I can't see that trajectory of people taking a high moral ground and saying, you're wrong and I'm right. LGBTI communities are not behaving in illegal or immoral ways. We're full citizens. But actually, he was doing something that was illegal. And that's really difficult to reconcile, I think.
Yeah, it's a massive contradiction, isn't it, between what he supposedly stood for and yet what he apparently, well, he's been proven in a court of law to be doing. It must be incredible for someone who has the Catholic faith to accept that that's, you know, that has been going on. But, it, you know, it seems so common. I mean, we're hearing about it so often. Ballarat, Bendigo, Trinity Grammar, George Pell. I can understand the burnt Catholic comment.
Yeah, well, I think one of the things that, you know, one of the reasons why I really love the work of Loud Fence is that they gave our families a way of talking about this. And I think, you know, where is the script for, you know, a church that you've put on the pedestal then finding out that they've perpetrated sexual abuse against your own family members? Like, where's the script for managing that? And where's the script for having a conversation and not feeling shamed? And how do, you know, people get their heads around, you know, my faith is the most important thing to me and yet you've done this, so
What is Loud Fence? Can you tell me about that?
It's a project that started in Ballarat. It's gone all the way around the world. And they took the four sort of epicentres of abuse by clergy in Ballarat and they tied ribbons to the fences. So one of them's St Patrick's Cathedral, another one's a school, another one's one of the legal centres. So the ribbon's on the fence and it's like, you know, no longer silent. We will not be silent. And so it's a show of support for the survivors, and the survivors talked about, I've got goosebumps talking about it, the survivors talked about seeing those ribbons and recognising that the community cares for them. That's, I guess, the first intent. But the other one too is it's about being loud and it's about saying that we're not going to be silenced and this is part of the history and we have to talk about it. And one of the things that's been happening in Ballarat is particular points, someone will actually come in at the dead of night and all the ribbons get cut down. And so there's a message out on Facebook and there's a call and people just go, I'm coming and I'm going to bring twice as many ribbons. And people do. And so the ribbons keep getting replenished because people are saying, you will not shut us down.
So it's about coming out of the darkness, really.
Because
I'm struck by, I keep going back to in my own mind of, you know, I know I'm not, I wasn't brought up Catholic, but, you know, I know a lot of Catholics. I've talked about the way they were brought up and, you know, religious teachings and that sort of thing. And the fact that sexuality was seen as a quite a dirty thing, even heterosexual sex was something that was just for childbearing and that sort of thing. And yet that's exactly what, you know, sexual behaviour and sexual abuse was exactly what they were doing, which seems just so incredibly contradictory to their own teachings.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff that's hard to get your head around. I mean, one of the things that, and I'm smiling now because we were hearing about, was it about 10 years ago, the Pope was saying we need to get more young people into the church. And so what they wanted to do was a tour around Australia and really generate interest amongst young people in the Catholic Church. And so they took some relics from Maria Goretti. Now, you need to know the story of Maria Goretti because it is the most head-spinning thing you've ever heard. I heard a woman once say, you know, that her neighbours who weren't Catholic got Winnie the Pooh and she got stories. And when she was a kid, she got Maria Goretti. Now, Maria Goretti was a peasant girl in Italy and the guy on the farm next door kept trying to sexually assault her. And she kept... And he must have not been Catholic. And so there was something around he was going to sexually assault her and there was a denouncing of, you know, her faith. And she kept refusing. So he came across and sexually assaulted her and then murdered her. What was the lesson that we were supposed to learn from that? And somebody said to me recently, was it that if you are, you know, that is the message to young girls that you should submit or be murdered? You know, like it's just... It's like I don't know how that's a story that would inspire anything other than fear.
But it strikes me that a lot of religion or organised religions do, you know, fear is the sort of central tenet of you know, faith and obedience and not questioning is around fear. Fear of not measuring up, fear of going to hell, that sort of thing.
Yeah, and I want to do a... feminist analysis of Maria Goretti. You know, I'm sure somebody's already done one, but I'm sure it would be fascinating. So, you know, there were parts about it that were fabulous. I mean, one of the things that I really love about Ballarat now is the nuns. I went to school with the Mercy Nuns. They are fabulous. They still are. They do really good social justice work. And the sense that I have is that they've kind of rolled their sleeves up and they're getting out there and doing it. And that's their way of kind of having faith rather than anything that's being espoused but is very different from the actual way life is lived.
It sounds like the women should have kept the control, well, had the control, and the men should have just disappeared into the background.
Yeah, well,
being facetious, of course.
That's not going to happen.
No. Let's talk about your career because you've got a very long career, as I said before, in social justice, but really around our older generations, the elderly. Tell me how you got into that.
I did my nursing training in Ballarat. And I got retrenched at the end of my nursing training and I wanted to stay in Ballarat. I wanted to earn some money so I could go overseas. And the only job that I could get was at the Queen Elizabeth Geriatric Centre, which was a benevolent asylum then. And I didn't want to go. Everybody said, you're mad. You'll just end up with a broken back and why would you do it? And I went, and I suppose I wasn't feeling valued because I'd been retrenched. Then I went to this aged care home, and I just went, oh, my goodness, these people are all amazing, and they're not being seen and valued either. So there was a kind of an identifying with older people then. And, you know, I still believe that older people are the most wonderful cohort of folk on the planet. Like, I love older people so much. I just think they are really, really incredibly interesting, and they love and live in different ways. And I get a lot of my energy from older people. And the work that I get to do now, I've got this best project that I ever came up with, and it's called the Elder Leadership Academy. And it was when I set up this Celebrate Aging program, which is around building respect for older people. And I thought, well, it'd be a really good idea if I worked in partnership with older people. That would be the right thing to do. And it's probably a very helpful thing to do. And so I started working with actually three older lesbians, working with them and saying, you know, would you, they were talking about issues. And I said, well, would you like to do some work together? And so I was supporting them. And, you know, boy, the work they did was absolutely amazing. And I realized that I thought it would be the right thing to do, and I thought it would be effective. I just didn't understand how powerful it would be. And then recognizing that's ageist. Why would we think that we wake up on our 65th birthday and our expertise is suddenly gone? So the work Anne Tudor and Edie Mayhew, a lesbian couple, they recently got married. Edie lives with younger onset dementia. So the work they've been doing in Ballarat has been around creating a dementia-friendly Ballarat. The work they've done is being recognised internationally. It's absolutely amazing.
Why do we ridicule our older generations? I always find that we either ridicule them, they're invisible, or they're not taken seriously. Why is that?
Fear of our own aging and death. And it's that terror management theory. It's the fact that we live in a world that is age-denying. And we're sold that in, you know, in the capitalist world in so many ways. Like, it's almost the cosmetics industry is almost a $1 trillion industry. And that's all about fighting the visible signs of aging. 7 million wrinkle treatments a year in the US. 23 million prescriptions a year for Viagra. It's all about going, oh, my God, I'm aging, I don't like it, I'm going to fight it. And I think what we're missing in all of that is that life is really incredibly precious, and there is an end point. And when we recognise that end point, there's an opportunity to live our lives in different ways. And when we do that, I think that we will be, when we value our own ageing, we will be more respectful of older people.
Because it strikes me that all those things you just listed are all about surface, and none of them acknowledge the intelligence and the vast experience of the, you know, anyone from 60 to 90, they've got decades of life experience. I find it bizarre that we just discount that experience based on an external, or maybe they speak more slowly, or I just can't put my finger on it.
Yeah, we are an incredibly ageist society, and we are so ageist we can't even see it. Like, it is so pervasive. And there are a number of campaigns and projects addressing ageism that have ageist slogans. And one of the ones that...
Really?
Yeah. And one of them is ageism is getting old. What do you mean in that context by getting old? You mean it has been? Well, you know, that's ageist. And people can't see it. And we've got to start calling it out, because until we call it out, it won't change. And we need to change. It's not a nice to have. Ageism, you know, like 10% of older people experience elder abuse, mostly by family members. The research shows that we on average think of ourselves as 7 years younger than we are, and thinking of ourselves as older than we are is equated with earlier mortality. So the older we think we are, the more likely we are to die, because we take on those ageist views and we don't act in ways that are empowered. So this is a really significant problem. And I think in LGBTI communities, we are more aware of our history, and we are more aware of the contributions that elders make. And so that makes us a little more enlightened, but we are still, LGBTI communities are still ageist.
I read an interesting article the other day about the horrific way we manage nursing homes, and the fact that we're sort of put somewhere when we can no longer care for ourselves, and we're just fed. It's like we're fed and watered, but there's not much other effort made to engage what are still very intelligent people with a lot to give. I want to just share briefly my grandmother's story. She lived to 100 and a half and died only 12 or so months ago. And she lived independently until she was 99. And she kept basically failing the entry to get into nursing homes because she was still very, you know, quite fit, her sharp, you know, mind very sharp, didn't wear glasses, was very, very fit for her age, for her body age is what I mean by that. And eventually she did go into a nursing home. But the reason her doctor was loath to do that was he said, you'll die within 6 months because you're going from doing your own shopping, paying your own bills, answering phones, making your bed, all that sort of stuff, to none of that. And that's pretty much what happened. Like, I noticed as soon as she moved into the nursing home, her mind was still very sharp, but physically she went downhill very quickly. And started taking advantage of, you know, walking around the nursing home, holding the rails that were there, where she'd never had that before. And, you know, she lost her physical strength as she used to carry shopping bags. But I also sort of realised that there was just not much for her there intellectually. She was an amazing lefty and would, you know, had great conversations about politics with her right up to the night before she died, in fact. You know, she didn't have the environment to thrive in a nursing home. It was like she was just sort of parked there until she passed on.
I'm sorry to hear that, Lisa, because, you know, a woman who is as amazing as your grandmother deserves to be respected right through until the end of her life. And we know that that doesn't always happen, and people are telling me it doesn't often happen. And I think what's happening with residential aged care homes is all horror stories are coming out, and they need to, and we need to look at the system, what's not working. And one of the things that I'm also saying is that we also need to look for, we also need to learn from examples where it works. So there are some residential aged care homes that provide the most beautiful care and dignity and respect for older people. What can we learn from them? And I think when we unpack the findings of the Royal Commission into aged care, I think one of the things that I'm hoping that we'll end up looking at is ageism. So if we're not, you know, there's so many people are saying one of the problems with in residential aged care homes is we have got workers who are not well educated. There's no regulation for them. So how are they being held to account? And there are no ratios. So no regulation, ratios, and no respect. And I think that's ageist to think that we can have just that we don't have to have a particular level of staff education or numbers of staff. And you think about, you know, the potential with your grandmother's case, if there were more staff, and then if they had adequate education around respect and around doing really engaging and interesting things, that might have had a different outcome for your grandmother and other people who were in that home.
I used to visit her, and it's one of the things that really repulsed me was that they had name tags on. And I just, for some reason, I just didn't like that. It just didn't
sit. The residents did?
Yeah. It just didn't sit well with me.
I'm screwing up my face too. It's not sitting well with me either. I mean,
I felt like that was weird. And they used to group. You sat at the same table for every meal, and they obviously tried to match you with someone who was mentally around the same capacity as you. And I kind of felt that my grandmother would have lived longer if she would have helped out in the kitchen or something. She would have loved that. Yeah. But she clung on to making her own bed for a while. In the end, they sort of took that off her too. So she went from doing a lot or everything for herself to doing absolutely nothing for herself. And I think it really messed with her emotional and mental life because she felt useless.
Yeah. Yep.
She wasn't looking after herself. And, you know, it's kind of like if you don't use it, you lose it. And that's pretty much what happened to her. But I think she would have liked to, you know, have done some work in reception or something. It would have kept her busy.
And why shouldn't she? And why shouldn't she be helping out with the meals? And why do you need name tags in your own home? I mean, people ought to know who you are, first name and second name.
Yeah. And, you know, names on the door and that sort of thing. So I found it very weird.
Yeah, it's quite an artificial environment. And again, I go back to the fact that there are some services that do it really well, and so why can't everybody? Do you know what I mean? Like, if there are services that are doing it well, then the others have a case to answer for.
Because there are other interesting models in mostly Scandinavian countries where they actually have students living with our elders in, you know, much smaller units, and you know both age groups are cooking for each other and engaging, and it seems like a really incredible opportunity. That why don't we match students who need housing with elders who
I don't know why we're lacking vision. I mean, those models are absolutely fantastic, because the older person's offering the younger person something: housing, company, experience and expertise, and the younger person's offering, you know, companionship and experience and expertise as well too. And, you know, housing in a city. But so why is there not the vision for that with older people? And I think, you know, I think at a federal level we've had a Minister for Aged Care. I think we need a Minister for Ageing, so that it's not just focused on the provision of aged care services, that we're looking at older people much more broadly and saying, well, how do we keep people in their own home? We know it's cheaper. And so how do we do that? And so there's money and packages being pulled in. But, you know, to really do some innovative thinking, like the models you're talking about, we need to do as well.
Now, I want to take you back to more personal things. You said before that you felt a bit different as a youngster. Was that, do you think that was related to your sexuality?
It might have been. I mean, I came out, I was out late.
How late?
Very late. I don't know, was I 46? And, you know, it's all relative. Some people are out later than that. 46 is, you know, I look back at photos of myself and I say, oh, I look like a lesbian. What does a lesbian look like? I don't know. But when I look at photos, I can see that I was a lesbian then.
Something intangible.
Yes, yes, yes. I don't know what it was, but I knew it wasn't safe. That's for sure. So when I was in my 20s, I did the crew cut, orange. And that was when I was living in Ballarat, and it didn't go down well. Yeah. So I knew in a lot of ways that it wasn't safe. So I think that was probably part of the reason for, yeah, I think that was probably part of the reason for coming out late, I think.
So from what I'm hearing, you were aware of your sexuality being not heterosexual, but you didn't want to have to deal with it once you had the haircut and realised that it probably wasn't a safe environment. So you smothered those feelings?
I think so. And actually I got married as well too when I was 30, and we were married for 15 years. And, you know, I don't regret marrying him. He's a lovely man. We're still really good friends. We go away once a year for a holiday together. But, you know, in some ways, if I'm really honest, I do regret not coming out earlier, because even though it was tougher times, I think you have different experiences as a younger person.
Do you think your marriage ultimately ended because your sexuality was a key, or were there other aspects?
There were other things happening. So the relationship ended, and then 6 months afterwards I came out.
Did you tell your husband, your ex-husband?
I did. He was thrilled because he was off the hook. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's like when the relationship finished, it's, you know, what have I done wrong? You've done nothing wrong. And I thought then that I was a lesbian, but I wasn't ready to acknowledge it to myself or anyone else. So I just said, you know, that this relationship needs to finish. We'd had relationship counselling. And then 6 months later, we went out to dinner. I said, I'm a lesbian. And he was he was thrilled.
That's hilarious.
He was thrilled. That's actually not an uncommon story. After divorcing, coming out was pretty easy, actually. Divorcing, you know, a good Catholic girl like me leaving my husband, that turned my world completely upside down.
Had you both made a decision not to have children?
We had at different times, actually. So when we got together, he wanted to have children and I didn't. I wanted to have a boyfriend and I wanted to travel the world and do fun things together. And then towards the end of our relationship, I wanted to have children and he didn't.
And when you came out, was it a big, I mean, you know, we come out every day, don't we? And we're constantly coming out. But when you came out, was it something that you announced to your friends and family pretty much all at once?
I remember going up home and having a conversation with Mum and Dad and feeling like I was going to throw up. So I would have been 46. and my brother had come out about 20 years earlier. And so when I came out to them, it was pretty much a non-event. And then probably the next thing I did, I went to a coming out support group. And it took me so much guts to go to this coming out support group. Like, I reckon I got changed 5 times. I was there half an hour earlier. But no one else came. It was just the facilitator and I, and the facilitator kept apologising for being heterosexual. So it just did not go down well. But that evening I went to, it was the comedy festival. And I don't know whether you know Monica Dullard's a comedian. So Monica and I did our nursing training together, or part thereof. And she had a caravan in the city square. And so I actually went up to the caravan and I said to her, and so she was the first person I said, Monica, I just want you to know that I'm a lesbian. And she just threw her arms out and came walking out of the van just with her arms outstretched to just give me this big hug. And I thought, well, if everyone can do that, I'm all right.
Have you had any pushback from family or friends?
No, I found that the experience of going through divorce gave me a pretty don't mess with me attitude, because I actually allowed people to mess with me with the divorce stuff. There was a lot of disapproval, you know, that really, it did my head in. So by the time I came out, I was just going, you know, you need to get your heads around it.
I want to throw something at you in terms of heterosexual marriage and divorce and queer relationships. I've often thought that it is harder to break up society accepted heterosexual marriage than a long-term queer relationship, because you have the family and the social structures around you and the legal structures. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, absolutely. There was something really kooky that happened, and people told me that it would happen, and I didn't believe it until it really happened. And what people said to me was that people identify with you. You know, they see you as a loving couple, and if you're separating, they're all just going, but what about us? You know, what are you saying about our relationship? And so they can't separate their own issues from yours. And so there was something that really powerful that happened. Like, people got really angry with me and they told me.
It strikes me that for future generations, kind of quitting on a same-sex relationship might be a little bit more difficult. Like, I'm looking back to my own history and, you know, you just kind of, you know, maybe 30 years ago I broke up a relationship that was 7 years, but there was no fanfare. We just stopped living together and, you know, there was no family support and there was none of that sort of gathering around or taking sides, which was a good thing. Yeah, I just noticed a very different response. It was sad, but it wasn't something that had any kind of
cultural expectation.
Yeah, there was no expectation. It was just like, oh, well, they've broken up. Let's all move on. But it'd be interesting now that we have equal marriage to see down the track if that has the same kind of kudos what's the other one? I'm struggling for words today. Just that acceptability from society.
Yep, there are kind of those well-established roles and role models. And one of the things that I do notice, I'm kind of the flip side of that, is that for people who are in longer-term relationships, that there's a kind of an adoring of them. Oh, we love you two together and you're so beautiful together. And I think, actually, sometimes I watch that and I think that's a bit of pressure, actually. And I think that we want, particularly same-sex couples, to stay together because we want the role models, I think.
Yeah, and now that it's become an institutional thing, you know, there will be that added pressure of, well, you got married, you had the legal ceremony, you had the party and the presents. You really need to kind of work harder to keep this together. I think it was easier in the past to walk away from same-sex relationships. That's just me.
Yep. Different. And can I say to you that one of the things that's been really interesting for me is watching elders marry. And there's a group of three lesbian couples in Ballarat who've been together collectively for 100 years. Not the three of them, not the six of them in one relationship. But I said to them, wouldn't it be wonderful if you all had, you know, if we had celebrations of your relationships? And then marriage equality came in and they all got married, all three of them. And so Dorothy and Mark have been together for 44 years and they are, you know, watching them get married at one point on their anniversary, I said to them, just for my own personal purposes, could I please have a photograph of you two kissing? And you know, there's this lovely photograph on my phone that I look at and just feel hopeful for the world and romance for myself. And so the two of them said, all right, we'll come outside. And then they went to kiss each other. And, you know, if you see a photographer taking pictures of someone getting married or something like that, and they'll kiss and then they'll turn around to the photographer and say, did you get it? Is that okay? But Dorothy and Marg kissed each other and then rested their foreheads against each other. And then that was like, I was just going, do you want me to leave? You know, like they were like minutes and they were just completely lost in each other's souls, 44 years.
Wow.
So beautiful. And then watching Anne and Edie last year, got married. Edie has younger onset dementia and they've been together 33 years. And Anne, we made a film of their recommitment ceremony and then being involved in their wedding. And Anne will say that that process healed a wound she didn't even know she had, and that when she and Edie got together 33 years ago, their relationship had to be pretty much hidden or sort of slipped under the radar because they didn't want to attract negative attention. So they weren't valued and affirmed and celebrated in the way a heterosexual couple is when they announce their engagement and then have a wedding. And so Anne talks about not thinking about that was a loss, but then when they got married and Edie had some dementia and Anne would ring me and say, I need to talk to you about these things because, you know, I can't always talk to Edie about these things. And I just need to tell you that I was in the newsagent today and the newsagent said, I'm so excited for you both and I'm going to have to get in more same sex. And all this stuff was just being affirmed and validated for who they were as a loving couple. And I think that is one of the things that I had underestimated, this opportunity to be valued and recognised, and then the impact it had on families. There are some families who have, you know, been a little bit not quite, and then watching elders getting married and they're just going, I not only see you as now legally the legal status, but actually I watch how you now have legal equality and how we've all come together to celebrate. And it's something switched. And I think if people had to get married to do that, if that's what it takes, great.
You describe yourself as a closet artist. Tell me about your art.
The art was never intended to happen, but it was around the time that I was leaving my ex-husband. I'd actually gone into Maya for a bra fitting and nothing would fit, and I just found that I had this absolute anger that I had to do something with. So I actually bought a bra anyway, just any old bra, and I went to the hardware shop and I bought a box of nails and I stuck about 300 nails in the bra. And it was this amazing experience where I looked at it and I saw what I felt. And so the outside of the bra was, you know, completely perfect and beautiful and, you know, the lovable slogan is, you know, lovable women understand. And so you've got to present this absolute sort of perfect exterior to be loved. That's one of the things that I get through life. There's this pursuit of perfection and we all think foolishly that we have to present ourselves as perfect to be loved. But actually the things that I hid, the imperfections that I hid, including my sexuality, which I thought was an imperfection, I could never have articulated it that way, but I did think it was, and they were the things that I hid and they were the things that made me sick. And so I just saw this and I thought, that's what I feel like. And so I just kept making them. I did another one and I sewed very small bullion roses on the outside of a brown bra and then I pulled all the thorns off the roses and I stuck them on the inside. And one year Midsummer indulged me with an exhibition, which was wonderful, and then I just kind of hid it. But I do want to go back to it because I feel like, particularly for women, the pursuit of perfection is so constraining. And I think what makes us fabulous is that we're all imperfect and flawed and whatever you want to call it. And embracing that, I think, is incredibly important.
I'm hearing a link between mental health and art. What are the other things you do to keep your mental health, you know, healthy, stable?
Gratitude's one of the things that I do. So I had, when I left my ex-husband, I had a fairly decent dose of depression, anxiety and panic attacks. Panic attacks, if you had those, they are no fun, no fun at all. But that was, you know, I just thought the world was ending. You know, I just thought this is as bad as it gets. And it was really, really messy. But the absolute joy of all of that was I got to then, you know, everything fell apart. And so then I got to decide how I wanted to rebuild. And rebuild I did. And I love myself in ways now that I didn't before. I love who I am. I'm much more of a liberated person.
And that's through acceptance of the fact that you have flaws and you're not perfect.
Yeah, yeah. And really learning to love myself and value myself. I'm not saying I get it right all the time. I still don't. But what happened after that was, so the depression and anxiety, I did a lot of work. And then what happened was I was kind of left with a residual kind of flatness. Like I felt that I had a really good life, but I couldn't feel it. I felt it. I knew I had a good life. I could intellectualize that, but I couldn't actually feel it. And then one day I saw something on gratitude and I went, you know what, I'm going to do a public declaration on Facebook. I'm going to do a 21-day challenge, make gratitude your attitude. And so I did that for 21 days. And for the first week or so, I was looking, you know, what will I take a photo today so I can post up on Facebook? But then I started to see more than one thing I could post. And then what I started to do was to see gratitude everywhere. And it wasn't so much the tropical island with the beautiful pool and the pineapple and the banana lounge. It was, you know, I'm grateful the sun came out today, or I got on the tram and the heater was on, or those really ordinary things. And then I started to notice my brain changed. And I noticed that I was seeing gratitude everywhere. I was seeing so many things to be grateful for. So I went, and then I found out it doesn't take 21 days to create a new habit. It takes 60. So I said, all right, I'm going to do this for 60 days. And then I went, well, why don't I do it for a year? So I did it for a year and I just thought I was cured. And I stopped it for a year. And then I just went, I can't ever stop actually, because the change in me is too enormous. So just before the one-year anniversary of the marriage equality postal vote thingy, I noticed that lots of my friends on Facebook were really flat, and I was talking to Sally Conning, one of the elders, and she was saying people were really flat. And so I said, why don't we set up a gratitude project for LGBTIQ folk? So we set up Grateful Rainbow, and boom, 800 people came on board in a month. And we said, we're going to do this for a year. We said we'd do it for 66 days. And of course, at 66 days, we had 800 people, and so we couldn't stop. But it is the most beautiful group of people, because people come there and they come out and they transition and they tell us they've got, you know, that maybe a family member's died or a relationship's ended or they've given birth. Or then people get on and say, I've got nothing to be grateful for today, but I'm really happy that you're here to be able to listen to me. Probably takes me somewhere between half an hour and an hour every day, because I've got to go on and make sure that everybody's okay and
everyone is grateful and not there's no trolling and bullying and negativity. Yeah.
So I'm on there every day, and I'm really grateful for that actually, because every day I'm having to do this gratitude thing. And sometimes when life feels like I am out there on the high seas, you know, just way over my head, gratitude is all I got. And, you know, it feels like a life raft. It feels like something to hang on to, and it doesn't change what I experience, but it changes my experience of it. If that makes sense, it doesn't mean that my situation has changed, but it really does give me something to grab a hold of.
How would you like to be remembered when you've left this earth? How would you like people to think of Catherine Barrett?
A compassionate and generous person, probably.
I think you definitely are that. I mean, we're not great friends, but I've known you for quite some years, and I see you as someone who is practicing gratitude every day and compassionate. And I, having spoken to you now, I've learnt so much more, and I can see that the heartbreaking things that have happened in your life have made you into something that is very cognizant of the feelings and the life of others. So I want to thank you for helping me today to see a different way of looking at things and for teaching me some interesting things. And thanks for sharing your story.
And thanks for this opportunity to talk about the real stuff.
Thanks, Catherine.
Thank you.
Word for Word is presented and produced by Lisa Daniel, with production support by Chris Tate from Australia's LGBTI radio station, Joy. Word for Word is distributed nationally to over 70 stations across the community radio network.
If you're experiencing difficulty, please reach out for support. You can reach QLife, an anonymous and free LGBTI support service, by calling 1800 184 527 or call Lifeline 24 hours a day on 131114 for crisis support and suicide prevention. In an emergency, please call 000.
every till the end.